Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Comedian Maggie May is sometimes described as a funny, smart weirdo. She takes that as a compliment, and rightfully so. Maggie says that her fly style is one of the things that sets her apart. She is definitely a comedian to watch and listen to. Maggie's expecting big things from herself, and so are we. We caught up with Maggie at her home in Los Angeles to talk about her journey from small town Texas to the bright lights of late night, and to find out what she loves most about being a comedian.
Making people laugh is the thing. It's the most fun. As a kid, I was always trying to make people laugh. That's all I wanted to do, is just make people happy for that moment. You know, I'm not thinking that I'm making someone happy for the rest of their life, but like just for that moment in my sphere of influence, I'm able to make them feel good or forget about their problems. Like that's always been what I've wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And by doing that, making people feel good and happy, that obviously makes you feel happy and good, right?
It's fun to do. It's just so fun to like see someone laughing and having a good time and knowing that you are part of the reason why that's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very heady feeling. You grew up in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas, and you were the only Black kid around. How did the other kids treat you?
Well, I guess after the fact, I'm able to see things a little bit differently. But at the time, I didn't really think that if I did encounter anything, it was a microaggression from usually a kid who didn't know any better, sometimes adults. But it was definitely a situation where I recognized I was different from everybody else.
See, I got called sassy a bunch growing up. I'm from the Rio Grande Valley. I was the only Black kid growing up. No one was really racist to me or anything. They were super pumped to have a Scary Spice for their little skits.
I just always kind of understood that how I was and like the upbringing I was getting and my point of view was going to be very different from people who did not have my same upbringing, did not have, you know, my same origin, I guess.
Mm-hmm. A lot of comedians identify as outsiders. Do you think that being the only Black kid may have had something to do with your decision to pursue a career in comedy, being maybe that you felt like an outsider?
I don't think that being the only Black kid was the catalyst for it. I also don't think that that was the only thing that made me different. In high school, I had a professor, Dr. Bolte, and one day he was just like, Maggie, there is no rubric for which we can measure that you would be considered normal. You are not the normal height. You are not the normal size. You're not in normal range of intelligence. You're louder than normal. Like everything about you is different. You know? And I grew up just kind of feeling like I was just a little bit different from everybody else, not necessarily just because of my race. I mean, I felt different from my siblings. Like I just kind of felt like a little bit of an oddball.
Right. How did that make you feel though, when he told you that you were different in all these ways?
At that point, I was really proud. You know, as a kid, you want to fit in. You know, I had moved from kind of northern Texas to South Texas, and I didn't really understand, you know, how that was, and I was different from everybody else. And there's a period, I feel, with children where they just kind of want to fit in and kind of want to see if people can understand them as they are and just try to be part of the group and try to be quote unquote normal. But the older I got, the more I was just like, I'm not going to fit in. Like, this is just not going to happen. So I should just embrace what makes me myself and be happy with that. At a church camp one time, I had a friend who had a word from God for me. And she said, you are surrounded by clay pots. Everyone is a clay pot. And you are a jeweled pot. And while you're a jeweled pot, you know, you're wonderful and you're brilliant and you're great. But in being a jeweled pot, you're never going to fit in with the clay pots. I would say that was something that I was just like, I'm going to be different and I need to embrace that rather than try to pretend that I'm the same as everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the fact that you embrace that was like a good thing, made, I think, probably made your life easier, that rather than trying to be someone, be sort of a false self and try to fit in with others, don't you think?
Right. You know, when you let your freak flag fly, other freaks are like, oh, there's one of us. And you find people who you're supposed to find, and you find your tribe, and you're never going to be happy unless you just own what you are.
Mm. Yeah, that's very true. Very true. Very well said. There wasn't much of a comedy scene in your hometown. So I'm curious, how did you start developing your stand-up chops?
See, I didn't start stand-up until I moved to Austin, Texas. I graduated from college kind of early, and I didn't know what to do. And so I just went to another college and started doing prerequisites for pharmacy school. And then I moved to UT because I wanted to go to the UT pharmacy school. And I got into pharmacy school in a small North Texas town and had to make a, I just had to be honest with myself that I really did not want to be a pharmacist. I just really enjoyed Ted Leo and the pharmacist. And this was not going to make me happy. And I had moved to Austin because I had hoped that I could do pharmacy on the side, you know, but it's like, why would I spend, you know, 3 or 4 years in school where I can't go and do acting things, or I can't go do comedy kind of things. Like, I can't do any of that. I'm going to be concentrating on school, and school is not even what I really want to do.
Mm-hmm. I've read that you often tell yourself that the material you write isn't good enough, yet when you tell that material on stage, it kills. So I'm curious to know, how loud is your inner critic?
Oh, that bitch is loud. I don't know if I could say that, but she's loud. I am always analyzing things. I didn't start comedy for a long time because I was like, there's no way I'm good enough to go to an open mic. And now you go to an open mic and you're like, wow, this is really just the wild, wild west. Anybody can be here and do whatever they want. But starting out, I was just like, oh my God, I've got to be professional if I want to go to this free sign up open mic and be able to tell my little jokes as well. I'm kind of a perfectionist, and I have kind of a high standard, which I've heard, I don't remember who exactly said this, but it's like, when you have a high standard and you know what you could be capable of, or you know how good a joke possibly could be, or how, you know, when you've experienced and watched other people do like really good jokes and really well thought out jokes, and you see that it can be really, really, really wonderful. And then you see the things that you're doing, you're like, wow, this is good, but there's a whole nother level of stuff out here that I'm not achieving, you know? And I think that that discrepancy is what sometimes makes people feel like they're not good enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you manage to overcome your inner critic to feel good enough to perform? Was it just a matter of, like you said, was it just a matter of sort of pulling yourself up by the bootstraps and just performing and realizing that at first you weren't going to achieve the goals, you know, that you set for yourself?
When I wrote the set, like my first set, and I'd written sets, and I'd just be like, ah, that's not good enough. And I wrote sets, and I'd be like, this isn't good enough. I need to work on it. And I never did. But this particular day, I wrote a set, and I told myself in my head, this is funny, but it's not good enough. I need to work a little harder. I need to practice a little bit more before I go to this open mic. And just clear as day, a voice in my head said, if you don't do this now, you're never going to do it. Just clear as day. And I was so scared that I would never do it, because like, I'd always wanted to, you know, that's always something I'd wanted to do. And I was so scared that that voice is right, that I would never do it, that I looked up an open mic that day and called in and signed up for it.
And how did that set go over?
In the moment, I thought I killed. I was just like, oh my God, this went so well. Like, it was way better than I thought it was going to be. For some reason, I thought that like, people were going to hate it or whatever. And it's kind of weird. Like, the first time I kind of thought that people were just being nice to me because it was my first time. Mm-hmm. And then the second time I was like, people are just being nice. Like, there's no way that this is good. And it wasn't until I did a big show. They had a contest in Austin, Funniest Person in Austin. And I did that contest my first time. And I was able to see, oh, wow, some of these people are just getting no response. Like, people are not out here trying to make people feel okay about themselves and about their sets. People are just responding normally. And in that show, I mean, it went over like gangbusters. And I was just like, oh my God, I guess maybe I'm funny and people aren't just trying to like, you know, make me feel better.
You appeared on Conan O'Brien's show a few years ago. Can you walk us through that experience?
That had to have been the best day. It was such a great day. The thing that was, I guess, the most present for me was that I didn't have anything else in my mind other than that. Like, everything went seemingly perfectly.
Oh, man, it's funny the kind of things that you'll notice when you're actually paying attention. Like, you'll notice not all inspiring phrases are inspirational. Like, you've all heard the one, dance like no one's watching. Someone probably put it on your Facebook wall with butterflies trying to inspire you. It's not inspirational. Like, that phrase literally says, hey, you should be yourself, but in private. No, like, you should be yourself regardless of who's there, regardless of who's watching. That is the point. They should change that phrase, I think. They should change it to, dance like you are not the father.
And back in Austin, I saw pictures later of like three different watch parties at like my favorite bar was one, and at some restaurant, and then at another bar that was close to where I hosted an open mic. And so that was also like, for me, just an eye-opening kind of thing of like, oh, wow, I'm part of a comedy community and we all very much love and respect each other.
Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. One of the things that really struck me about your set on Conan was the way you told these very smart jokes about racism.
Here, people will use the word racist to describe when a white person does black people stuff. How is it racist for a white person to do black people stuff, but it's not racist to think that there's black people stuff?
What is your creative process like to approach such a sensitive topic?
Well, there was a comic once that said that it's hitting a target without letting people know that you're hitting that target or that you're aiming for the target. And so with things that are sensitive and things that, you know, people have the potential of getting kind of up in their hackles about, you just have to really delicately ease someone into it. The point is to get someone to laugh at what you're saying, to listen to what you're saying and laugh at what you're saying. They can't laugh at you if they don't want to listen. So you just got to put it in a way that they're listening and they're not feeling, you know, self-conscious. They're not immediately defensive or anything. You just have to do it in such a way that you get them to listen and hear, and they're laughing before they realize that, oh gosh, there was something else behind this that I needed to understand.
You also perform sketch comedy and improv. How does stretching those creative muscles influence your stand-up?
I feel like just doing comedy in general, doing any sort of type of comedy, is going to help other types of comedy because you're in that headspace. You're always in the headspace of like, let me create something. If you're writing a sketch, you're like, okay, well, let me paint this world. What am I going to do to make this come alive? How am I going to make this character to be a live character and not just something flat? So when you do stand up, essentially some of your jokes are like storytelling. And so it's that same concept of like, how am I going to build this world? How am I going to get people interested in this story? How am I going to add little jokes around what I'm trying to explain so I keep them engaged? It's staying in that comedy headspace and realizing that there are different ways that you're going to be able to flex that comedy muscle.
Okay, there is some real gritty white out there. Like, I've dated a lot of, hey, I play bass in a Korn cover band kind of ones. My type is red flag. I'm into that. Man, I'm from Texas. I have dated a lot of, hey, I fist bump my daddy on Christmas kind of white. Texas. Gritty white, that's sexy to me. I'm into that kind of thing. Like a dude that like, you get a car with him and like he gets pulled over, he backhands the cop and you still don't go to jail. Like, that's exciting to me. Like, just that intersection of white privilege and poverty, that is a fun intersection to be in.
What is next for you?
I'm working on a lot of writing for myself, things that I'm trying to take out of conception and put it into reality.
Mm-hmm. Execute.
That's what I'm trying to
yeah.
do. Right, right. And I'm really working on honing my acting chops and like going, you know, back to class and everything like that. Because I want to be on a show. I like performing. I think that would be a great next step for me.
Yeah, I agree. because you have a great presence. You're different.
Thank you.
Which is Thank you. I mean, you're different, which is a good, which is a bonus. And in this world, it's hard to be different. So yeah. So we'll look forward to whatever comes next. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you very much, Maggie Mae. Thanks for the great conversation.
I had a great time with y'all. Thanks for having me.
Maggie Mae is a stand-up comedian, sketch comedian, and an improviser. You can find out more about Maggie and her comedy at WPR.org/beta.
I went to see the screenings, one of the early screenings, with my son. We came out and I said, Paul, what'd you think? He said, Dad, he nailed you.
That screenwriting expert, Robert McKee, on seeing his adaptation in the film, Adaptation. He joins us next to explain why complicated characters are the future of prestige TV. Coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.